TFM.
Welcome, Boomers, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Star Trek Enterprise podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I can barely see you. I don't think you've activated your external lighting.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I totally forgot. And, you know, I'm just not being, you know, familiar. I just not so used to... I'm so discombobulated. It's so weird being back in 2004, Chris, you know, and so, you know, all the buttons are seem bigger and the OS is funky and
the OS is funky.
I don't know what to do. Anyway,
glad we finally made it. You can't touch all the panels or anything right now.
Oh, it's just,
right?
I can't touch anything anymore. It's just really difficult. So.
All right. Well, you know, you can pilot a starship, so I'm sure that those skills will pay off no matter
sure I've got it,
what
know?
Kind of vehicle so, you're trying to control. So,
yeah. I mean, how hard could it be, right?
Well, everyone, we are going to talk about the year 2004 today as we continue our rewatch of Enterprise with episode 11 of season 3. It's Carpenter Street. And here is a quick rundown of the story. As the Zindi continue to develop their superweapon to destroy Earth, the Zindi reptilians decide to take matters into their own hands and create a bioweapon. To do so, they need a sample of each human blood type. Where best to find that? Detroit, Michigan, of course, in the year 2004. When temporal agents get wind of the incursion, they send Daniels to let Archer know. Though details are thin, he sends Archer and T'Pol back in time to stop the lizards from completing their mission. So, Matthew, I like the fact that we have lizards running around, and we even get that in the episode a little bit when Loomer goes off on his little spiel about lizards and ray guns and stuff like that. And
yeah, it's like they'd all watched V. You know?
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. It made me think about V, both the original, which I watched growing up, and the remake that they did back not too long after this episode aired, actually. That was around 2004, 5, 6, something like that, when they did V. So we're bringing Daniels back here, and we're tying back into the temporal Cold War. So this is part of the arc. It's actually the... 9th episode of 13, which make up that entire temporal Cold War arc. For the Zindi crisis itself, it puts us right around the middle. There are 28 episodes in that arc, and this is the 12th one. So how do you feel about this as being part of that temporal Cold War story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it was a good reminder as an episode as to... This whole arc, I mean, this whole season, you know, is really predicated off of, you know, this being a part of the temporal Cold War. And so I think this episode does a good job of reminding us of that. But it also helps remind us that, you know, as seemingly all-knowing as this organization that Daniels works for is, there is still so much that can happen that they don't understand. And so the fact that he's come to Archer is because something has happened here with the reptilians going back in time that isn't something that has happened, you know, isn't supposed to happen, isn't something that makes sense to them. That this is not part of any of the timelines to which, you know, they've been watching. And so, you know, I think that is a really interesting thing for this. I think it also just kind of ramps up the tension for the episode because it does become one of those things about what's going to happen then. Because, you know, you don't ever expect necessarily that, you know, Archer T'Pol is going to die.
Right.
Could they get seriously injured or, you know, something like that happen? You know, all of that, I think, is within the realm of possibility in this episode. So I think by bringing Daniels back and also making him somebody who, comes to Archer basically in a time of need, his need, is really, really fascinating. And it's a good beginning to the episode, and it kind of sets the stage for this episode. And a big part of that, too, is, I mean, this episode's beginning is so different than any of the other episodes we've really seen. I guess they've done this to us previously with North Star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They kind of had an interesting cold open there with that. And so this is another way in which, yeah, we're going to continue the storyline that we've been telling throughout the season, but we're also going to kind of take a detour. And I just, this whole thing too, I mean, just the way in which you've got these different factions of the Zindi too, I think all of that plays out really well in this episode. So it's just one of those episodes that I think is doing a lot of different things with a lot of different threads that they've utilized throughout the season. And some of them they've kind of left hanging. And this episode in some ways helps to answer some of those as to what some of these different factions and characters are actually up to as a result of, you know, their own internal squabbling.
Mm-hmm. Well, I never thought T'Pol might die in this episode, but I thought she might eat a French fry and kind of, you know, her whole vegetarian thing would be down the drain thanks to time travel.
She might have, she might have gotten some sort of like food poisoning having a French fry after the diet that she's normally used to.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you could definitely see that happening if she'd just chosen to eat the French fry.
I did like the little Burger King joke in there, though, when she said that she wouldn't have it. Yes. He said, have it your way.
Yep. That I thought that was very, very funny. It's one of those that can wonderfully just pass you by if you're not necessarily paying attention. That's stuff right there. That's clever.
Yeah. So, yeah, this premise was interesting. We already know that the reptilians are going to kind of do their own thing anyway. That they're not necessarily going to fall in line with the rest of the council. So the idea that they're going to go and try to do something like this does make sense for the story that we've gotten up to this point. I think one thing that's interesting about it is the choice of setting. So deciding to go back to 2004. And Brian Braga said about that choice that they considered various time periods and they thought it would be cool to do an episode in contemporary times, and then they settled on doing it literally in the time that they were in. Now, it aired in November of 2003, and the story takes place in October 2004, so it's about a year in the future from when we're watching it, but, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's the same time, so it's meant to be very contemporary for us as we were watching. And I remember when it first aired, and this is something I think sometimes gets a little bit, maybe lost isn't the right word, but the impact is not the same when you watch stories that are set in contemporary times, when you watch those decades later. So The Voyage Home, for example, you probably remember watching that in the theater when it aired, and it was basically the time that we were in. So it had a certain feeling for us then, versus when you go back and you watch it now. And it still feels very familiar, but it also feels a little bit dated. And this one for me is sort of like that as well. Like it feels like I'm watching a crime drama from the late 90s or the early 2000s. But when it first aired, it had that impact of like, hey, they're back in our time. The Zindi reptilians, they could be right outside my house right now. So that was a reasoning anyway that they had. And another reason that Braga gave was that it allowed them to make the character of Loomis feel more relatable for the audience. But beyond that, one question I had for you, tell me what you think about those. But another one was, do you feel that choosing to set the story in our own time as we're watching the episode originally helped to raise the stakes for what humanity was facing, what Archer and the crew were facing, the idea that humanity could really be destroyed? It's one thing to think about it in the future, 100 years or more from now, but to be facing that threat in the moment could potentially raise the heat in that storyline for the viewers.
You know, one of the things you mentioned real quick, it was the idea of it feeling like a lot of the television crime dramas of the time. And, I thought that one of the things that they kind of did well with this episode was kind of tap into that. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, with the setting, being Detroit at that time period, Detroit was slowly, slowly, slowly on the rise, but still not where it is today. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it actually reminded me kind of one of those, 70s paranoid thriller type of feeling to it, because it all takes place at night. You know, it all mm-hmm. takes place within one night, really, once mm-hmm. they get there. So I really liked that whole vibe. I actually thought that was incredibly well done. And so therefore, the choice to go back to 2004, I thought, made sense. It makes sense for the story. It makes sense for the type of people that, you could kind of, I think, easily find in a place like Detroit, who are down on their luck, who are looking to make a quick buck. They don't really care. I think all that is really well done. The whole question of whether or not this also helps kind of bring to light this idea that humanity wouldn't have a future if the Zindi are successful mm-hmm. in this time period. I mean, it's kind of terrifying, right? And I think, the episode also juxtaposed that with, choices that humanity is making at the time as well, to kind of accentuate that, the idea of like, basically, and it's not subtle, but there's definitely the nudging of like, hey, your time could be up if you don't stop the behaviors that you're doing now. Mm-hmm. And so that's all a part of it. I mean, again, that's just very Star Trek in that sense of trying to get us to see ourselves, in that way. And this is one of those opportunities where it's very much more in your face, because it's just showing us mm-hmm. who we are. And so, I think this is actually one of those places where their choice to go back in time, their choice to go back to a time that we're much more familiar with, because it's right around the corner when this aired, is much more successful in many ways. And we'll get there on to the journey. But I honestly think this is much more successful than when Voyager goes back to, 1994 mm-hmm. in Future's End. I think mainly just because it really does fit this story specifically. And really, it's because, I think you mentioned, but Braga mentioned, the character of Loomis is so much more relatable in mm-hmm. in this era than it would be in some of the other eras. Like, if you go back to the, if you go back to the 80s or whatever, that's maybe a little bit more difficult. 90s, it's probably a little bit more difficult to feel like this character is just like that. But I mean, seriously, you go to a seedy underbelly of a city like Detroit in the early 2000s, makes sense. You put this in like the 70s, you're like, oh yeah, in New York, you could totally buy this happening. Mm-hmm. And so there are those time periods in which it just kind of makes sense for the story. And it just happened to really work for them for this. And so I just think all of the choices that they made really helped. Not only that, but when you go and film in a location and, you're able to film at night, you kind of have that look like it's always just rained kind of feel to it. Mm-hmm. Again, you get that noir or almost like 70s paranoid thriller type of vibe. That's exactly what you want this to feel like. And so, mm-hmm. I know it's just a bunch of effusive praise, but rewatching the episode, and I've seen this episode many times, I was just really surprised at how all of those choices were still working for me all these years later,
Yeah, well, I think that's where the contemporary feel does help a lot, right? That, even though we're now more than 20 years later, but things haven't changed that much. So it's still, those things work.
I mean, other than the OS,
Than the OS, it's not quite as janky as it used to be.
Although, yeah, it's true. It's not.
Although we have gone back to Windows Vista Aero glass look with the liquid glass of Apple's OS suddenly. Yeah. But, you know, shooting on location, yeah, I think it works well. We should point out, of course, that this episode is mostly shot in Los Angeles, not in Detroit. But I think that they do a good job of not making that too obvious. And so you feel like it works fine. Like, I can certainly buy that this is Detroit. I'm sure if someone lives in Detroit, they probably know. It's like every time I see a movie or a TV show that is shot in Tokyo, to me it looks crazy because the areas they say they're in are not the areas that they say that they're in.
Yep.
But that holds true for...
Same thing happens with Seattle. When I see if, you know, I mean, I remember when first moved up to the Pacific Northwest, went there, and, you know, my wife and I had been watching Grey's Anatomy and like, wow, they really get all this geography really wrong in this show. So,
yeah, anyway. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So
that happens to everyone who lives in a city that's being used as a location. So, I was thinking in here, though, other ways that the reptilians could have gotten a sample of each blood type. One of them, with this being Detroit, is to pose as the mascot for an opposing team and just go into the Detroit Lions locker room and get samples that way. And I also thought of other places they could have gone besides Detroit, since they're just going back in time. They can go to different things. So Woodstock would have been a good one, of course, but maybe the best, just go to Burning Man. You can have no problem finding people who you can easily get blood samples from. You can get them all in one place. You can be in and out of there in one night.
No lies detected here. Yeah. I mean, so
and think,
but
think
I,
about
you
it.
Know, the reptilians, you know, they just don't know that much about Earth. They don't know much about our customs, and they didn't really want to learn about us. You know, they just wanted to take advantage of us. And so, I mean, it makes sense, right?
But also, can you imagine Zindi reptilians at Burning Man, where they have to be running around with no clothes on? And that's
you know, everybody's so high there that they wouldn't even notice anything was weird about them. I guess so.
Well, you know, this is the first episode of Star Trek that got a TV-14 rating, but if it had been at Burning Man, I think it might have gotten another rating.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't even have MA at that point, so, you know.
All right. So the blood samples anyway, the bioweapon. I was also thinking about why is a bioweapon a part of the temporal Cold War story here? Because the Zindi are building this massive weapon, which would come and actually just blow the planet up. But then there's this other project that the reptilians have of, hey, let's make a bioweapon. And given the time that this story is written, I have to think that part of that is influenced by what was happening in the world at the time. That was when the U.S. was accusing Saddam Hussein of developing weapons of mass destruction. And so just as season 3 of Enterprise is in some ways a reaction to the 9/11 attacks, I feel like the idea of the reptilians trying to create this bioweapon in the first place is just an extension of that.
I mean, yeah, I get that. And I think it feels very real. This idea that they would be thinking of a bioweapon. I think, you know, one of the things that's really interesting about the reptilian choice here is they decide that they're going to do their own thing. They're going to go their own way. They do so. And to go back in time and create a bioweapon to destroy humanity before they even get the chance to get to the point where they could, you know, come and destroy them is very interesting. I mean, it really, what I find most fascinating is this is the most human of games, right? Where we like to play this idea of, oh, if you could go back in time, you know, who would you kill? And so this is very much in that same vein of, okay, if you could go back in time and kill all your enemies with one shot, would you do it? And because you know, I think what makes this so interesting is that the reptilians, I don't think, like being beholden to anyone, even within right. their own species, you yeah, know, yeah, yeah. And I think they do such a good job in this season of building this really dynamic group of individuals and species within this Zindi species itself. Mm-hmm. And I think that just creates a lot to play with. And so, mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, the idea of doing a bioweapon, not only is it relevant now because, you know, we've all lived through COVID, mm-hmm. But it's also was just as relevant then.
Yeah.
And I think it's something to which is kind of terrifying, this thought process that, you know, anybody would play with biology in this way to attack somebody on the most fundamental level. I think mm-hmm. that in and of itself is just so terrifying as a mm-hmm. thought. You know what I'm saying? Like, I think that in some ways, almost a bioweapon is more terrifying than just like a Death Star, basically.
Right.
Because
right.
it's so much more realistic for us right. to envision that actually happening, you know?
Well, it's especially terrifying and short-sighted in our own world because we all have the same biology. So if you create a bioweapon to attack your enemies on Earth, it right. can always come back to bite you as well. In the case of the Zindi here, the Zindi reptilians, maybe they engineer something that only wipes out humans and doesn't affect Zindi. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just kept thinking about the bioweapon part because the thing about the Zindi is that they can destroy humans with the military assets that they already have without developing something like a bioweapon. But that also holds true on Earth too, right? We've mm-hmm. had governments throughout history, 20th century into the 21st century here, who have had projects to develop bioweapons
yeah.
who don't necessarily need them because they have conventional weapons or nuclear weapons and forces that would be enough to achieve their goals. But yet there's like this... there's this certain mindset that goes into, well, what if we did this and we used biology against people? So, yeah, I felt like that was another very much contemporary element. And I think at the time, not that it's not going on now as well, but I think in the moment when this episode aired, it was something that was very much in the forefront of people's minds and fears and
mm-hmm. yeah.
played a lot into the inclusion of that in the story here.
I had a question for you. Why do you think it is that Archer chooses to Paul to go back with him? Is this because, you know, this is just an opportunity for him to finally show her that time travel exists mm-hmm. and she'll not be able to deny it anymore? Or is it just because she's truly the best person to go with him? Because my thought process was watching this episode, man, it seems like Trip would have actually been pretty helpful because he seems like the type of guy, you know, we already know from the series, he would go parking, you know, down by the wherever it was, you know, with his girlfriend in a vehicle. And so he's familiar with the technology of the era and mm-hmm. all that kind of thing. So I just wanted to get your thoughts on why do you think it was that Archer chose T'Pol?
Well, the first thought is the one that you mentioned, which is that it is an opportunity to try to finally win her over where time travel is concerned, because it is something that she's your first officer. You need her to believe that these things are real. And she's been so resistant to it. And despite the fact that, you know, you've got this guy that keeps showing up on the ship out of the blue, where does she think he's coming from? I mean, like, she's seen enough that she should believe, but she still doesn't. And so here's a chance to, like, actually take her back. And she can't really deny it at that point. And that's one reason. I think another thing, though, is that, like, I'm not sure if, of course they would, because they are the heroes of the story, and so they're going to win. But if we're looking at this realistically, I'm not sure that Archer and Trip going back, the two of them together, I'm not sure they would have accomplished the mission. Because I think that taking to poll, having someone there with you who is not going to fall victim to the emotions of the moment is important.
Yeah, it's a good possibility.
That plays in a bit too to the whole good cop, bad cop thing that they had going on as well. Mm-hmm. But you've got one thing you've gotten to pull is you have someone with super strength compared with mm-hmm. humans. Yeah. So she's going to be able, if they find themselves in a situation where physical strength is going to become an issue, she's got that, right? And she even mentions it to Loomis in the story that, you know, don't worry, I'm not going to be incapacitated or helpless.
Right.
Just because you pull a knife on me. And I think, you know, Trip could have easily been overpowered. There are things like that. So, I mean, as a Captain Archer might be thinking about all these scenarios and the strength, the logic, the not being concerned about emotions or making emotional decisions. I think all these things also play into making T'Pol the best choice.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great thought. And I hadn't necessarily contemplated the idea of whether or not, you know, having Trip there, that emotionalism that he would have might get in the way. And yeah, I think that makes sense, especially since, you know, Archer himself is definitely, as the season moves forward, mm-hmm. he is finding himself, his emotional control slipping a little bit further and a little bit further because the pressure is continuing to mount on him, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think what's fascinating is just watching this in retrospect as well is that T'Pol is also a person whose emotional core is slipping a little bit more as the season goes on. And we don't necessarily know that quite yet. And though, watching it again, we do. And I think that's something that makes that really interesting for us then on this rewatch for the 20th anniversary. We get the opportunity to be reminded of those type of stories. And so I think that stuff is all really cool. And yeah, I mean, the whole idea, like you mentioned, of this kind of good cop, bad cop that they end up playing, Loomis definitely, I think, is completely taken aback by these characters who he thinks he's going to be able to, you know, worm his way out of things, that they're not going to quite, understand how charming he is or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they're just, neither of them is fooled in any way, shape or form. And so, I thought that they did, again, the whole idea of kind of putting this in the framework of one of the police procedurals mm-hmm. really, really worked, in this episode. And I thought they did a great job with that. So,
yeah. And after they do finally take him out and they stop by and they have to deal with the drive-through, I love that when you go back to the 21st century, you have to deal with the terrible drive-through speaker and all of the upselling of combos. Yes.
Do you want to make that a combo?
Yeah. But what I also liked about that scene is I liked that Archer, as the captain of the first Warp 5 starship, orders a burger with ketchup only.
I remember
myself. So these days I love, you know, everything on the burgers. But when I was growing up, when I was a kid, I always had to have ketchup only. And it always created problems because, in junior high school, like in the band parents, mm-hmm. they've got to go get like 100 burgers for everybody for lunch in the middle of practice.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can't be that kid that wants ketchup only because that just doesn't work. You've got to do a mass order of everything, right? And so that stood out to me when Archer ordered that.
I found that was the one thing, this is such a weird nitpick, but that was the one thing in the episode that I found to be a little bit jarring and kind of pulled me out of the episode in some ways where I'm like, wait,
that he would know
what?
To ask for that in the first place?
He literally only likes ketchup on his, like that's it? Like, are you kidding me? It was such an odd thing for Archer to be so particular about, and just made very little sense to me. And I was like, come on, we've seen Archer have like all of these great meals on the Enterprise. Yeah. You know, he seems to, you know, and then the fact that he's gonna be a child and eat a burger with only ketchup on it, it was just kind of weird.
I think have been kind of pairing it with the have it your way with the French fry. It might have been another one of those, you know, if you want ketchup only, you can get ketchup only. So
possibly.
I don't know. I didn't research this. I don't know if Burger King was a secret behind the scenes sponsor of this episode or not.
Man.
All right. All right. Well, what are your final thoughts on this one? And what's your rating?
Honestly, I mean, I think this is a good episode of the season. I think they do a great job. Like I mentioned before, I think they build on a lot of different elements that have come from the season and then begin to play those out, especially with, you know, what we know about the Zindi reptilians and their desire to do all they can to make sure that the destruction of humanity comes at any cost. And so finally getting the opportunity to see the way in which they are making that happen on their own in the past is pretty fascinating. And I think this is also one of those, you know, storylines that is going to continue to play into the rest of the season, right? And so that's what I love as well. This is definitely not, this is not the one-off completely in many ways like we got with North Star, but this is a nice reprieve from just kind of the same old we seem to have had in a lot of the episodes. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but I just mean like, you know, this is a great way to further the storyline of this arc while at the same time doing something completely different. And so smart writing, really well done, incredibly well executed production-wise. I thought the production of this episode is phenomenal. It looks so good, too, on the Blu-ray copy, you know, and as we were talking about, you know, the Voyager episode not looking good in the stream, this having this on Blu-ray, the work they did for that, it's wonderful. I you know, can't speak highly enough for the work that they put into those. And so, yeah, I'm honestly just going to give this a 5 out of 5 bioengineered weapons. So because I think this is an excellent episode of this season. What about you, Chris?
Yeah, I think it was effective to go back in time and to go back to this time period. It added a twist to the story. I think the fact that the story itself is playing with time anyway, that there's this temporal Cold War and there are these incursions going on. We hear about incursions, but actually seeing something like this happen and there being no record of it in history, I think it adds even more life to the storyline. Even if the temporal Cold War ultimately is a half-baked concept, it helps add a little bit to it. I thought bringing Daniels back was interesting. I feel like he should know more about what's going on. He should tell Archer a little bit more. If he's going to send them back to Detroit, he should send them back sometime other than like the final night when they're about to get the last couple of blood samples they need. But the fact that he doesn't, it could highlight that, hey, you know, this thing isn't supposed to be happening. And one of our agents who's there caught a glimpse of these Zindi reptilians and let us know. We just found out. We don't know what's going on. And also looping back to the whole theory that maybe Future Guy is Archer makes you think of an interesting time loop that could be going on here of Archer having experienced this, but it didn't show up in history, and there's this some kind of time loop going. You can like think of all kinds of crazy things that won't necessarily make sense if you're trying to tie them into what we've seen on screen. But if you're really just coming up with theories, it's kind of interesting. So I think it worked really well. I did want to ask you if you noticed one thing when Loomer goes to Strode's apartment to get him to come back because he wants to get his blood sample, and then he turns him over to the Zindi. Did you notice the number of Strode's apartment?
I was at 47?
No, it's 602.
Oh, I missed that. Okay.
It's the 602 club. I think the 40 is Loomer's, but yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, 602 is there. So but no, I enjoyed the story. I think it was a nice diversion amid everything else that's going on with the Zindi arc and the mission and the expanse. So I'm going to give this one, I'm actually going to sweeten the pot for T'Pol in her salad and offer 8 strips of bacon still for only 75 cents extra.
Oh man, that is, I'll take that deal.
All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on Carpenter Street. There are many ways for you to share those with us. Perhaps the easiest way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversations beyond the podcast. So if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. You can also send us email. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose Warp 5, and that will come to us by email. And you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we would love to get that from you as well. Now, Matthew, when you're not hot wiring cars, only to find out that they've already got a wheel clamp on them, where can people find you?
It's the worst. You can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02. Of course, here on the network, outside all this great Star Trek talk from Chris Jones and I, you can find me in the 602 Club talking about all of the franchises we love outside of Star Trek, plus a lot of great bonus shows in that same feed. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network with 2 shows. One is called Outpost, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time, as well as being over on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But Chris, you know, when you're not trying to figure out exactly what you want on your hamburger, if you want the combo or not, where can people find you?
Yeah, I'm not going to go ketchup only anymore. I'm a grown man now. I like everything on there. Pickles, mustard, 3 strips of bacon, everything. So I'm going to go with that. But you can find me, as you mentioned, elsewhere on the network doing all those shows with you. You can also find me in the back catalog on lots of shows. Larry Nemechek and I have a new episode of The Ready Room as well. So check out all of those if you want to hear more of my thoughts on Star Trek. And if you'd like to chat on social media, you can find me everywhere. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. Blue Sky is where I'm most active, but you can find me everywhere, and I'd love to hear from you. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time when we're going to go exploring some mysterious spheres in the Chosen Realm.
Well, Chris, that sounds fantastic and terrifying. So let's go.